Before we dive into today's trip down memory lane, a quick shout out to the fine folks at Remind Magazine, who help keep the nostalgia train rolling. This season, the Pop Culture Preservation Society is proudly sponsored by Remind, the publication that understands your collection of Tiger Beat magazines, TV guide issues, and random lunchboxes is not clutter, it's history. We love when Remind lands in our mailboxes, and we can enjoy that analog experience of flipping through its pages and reading all about the classic TV shows and movies and music and all of those pop culture treasures that made us who we are. And as an exclusive offer to PCPS listeners, you can get a full year of Remind magazine for just $12. That's 86% off the cover price. Just go to remindmagazine.com/pop. That's remindmagazine.com/POP. And you can take advantage of this incredible offer. Trust us, you will be so glad you did. He sells them. So I will put a link in our show notes with how you can order
Christopher's wood.
Christopher's wood. Wood creation.
Hello, world. There's a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. A whole lot of loving is what we'll be bringing. We'll make you happy.
Welcome to the Pop Culture Preservation Society, the podcast for people born in the Big Wheel generation who learned geography from Rand McNally road atlases.
We believe our Gen X childhoods gave us unforgettable songs, stories, characters, and images. And if we don't talk about them, they'll disappear, like Marshall, Will, and Holly on a routine expedition.
And today, we'll be celebrating the art of the second act, because apparently teen idols grow up to become painters and farmers and writers and orchestral composers. I'm Carolyn.
I'm Kristen.
And I'm Michelle. And we are your pop culture preservationists.
It's gonna have to be a different man.
So what happens when those celebrities we idolize growing up grow up themselves and begin leaning into their passions? What kind of second acts do they create for themselves? Well, today we're going to talk about some of those stars and some of those second acts that they've created. There's kind of a creative freedom that they're leaning into that comes later in life. And then you'll get to hear our great conversation with Greg Evigan, who is definitely embracing his second act. Perhaps there's no better example of this than our friend and first crush, Sean Cassidy. In our conversations with him, we learn about his journey from performer to writer, producer to songwriter and performer again. His latest creative project has found him writing music and performing again, something he hadn't done since 1980 at the peak of his teen idol stardom. But you could tell just by talking with him how much being able to lean into this creative freedom was filling his soul. Don't you guys agree?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think creative freedom is that, like, that's the key term, right? Because it could be that the reason a second act is necessary is because your first act, there wasn't freedom.
Freedom, right?
And you really, when you talk to Sean Cassidy, you really get that feeling that this was something that was sort of expected of him, and he was young, and so he was taking people's advice, and he didn't have tons of control.
Right.
And so he left it all behind.
He always, you know, he was like writer first. They say like dancer first or whatever. He was... That's what his true passion was, was to be a writer. And my goodness, for, you know, how many decades did he do that so well?
Like 40 years.
He's so much so that even his kids, that's what they thought dad did. Like they didn't think dad was a singer and a teen idol and an actor even, really. It was more... Dad's a writer. Dad writes TV shows.
They don't have any knowledge of him as being in front of the camera or singing at the Grammys or being on an album cover. They only know him as a writer.
Right. Mm-hmm. And what I love is almost this full circle moment of he is performing again and he's doing it for himself and, you know, for the right reasons and for us. I mean, again, we've our conversations with him and listeners, if you have not already heard those, please go back and listen to those episodes because you can hear in his voice and his excitement about what he is doing right now, going on the road, performing songs that he is writing again now, and how that is filling his soul. And it's just really inspiring to listen to.
As a grown-up, he's a grown-up
well,
now.
And yeah. I feel like it's such a good illustration of all of us when we get to be a certain age.
Yeah, and that's where Gen X is right now. I mean, we do have this freedom that we can embrace. And also, you know, we don't give as many F's as we did before. So it's like, if I want to become, you know, whatever, a potter or a, I don't know, cobbler, if that's what I want to do.
Shoemaker.
I'm going to be a shoemaker.
But that's a really good point, Carolyn, because I think we've gotten to the point in our careers, many of us, like, we've done this for so long now that we're no longer climbing or scrapping or wanting or desiring. We either had it or we missed the boat. And so it's fine. It's fine. Like, can we make room for something else to go along with paying the bills? I think one of the first times we as children noticed that a celebrity might become something other than a celebrity was Shirley Temple. Uh-huh. A lot of us had fascinations with Shirley Temple when we were kids because she was a kid and she was just so cute. You just wanted to squeeze her with your little hands till she popped.
Like, I wanted to be her, though.
Oh, of course. Of course you wanted
to be her. And wasn't Heidi one of those, at least for me, just those films that the teachers would bring out in school? Like, you would just, that and the Red Balloon movie, you know, that those were like the go-tos when they needed an hour and a half of no kids bothering them, whatever, report card time,
Heidi,
and you'd sit on the floor
big.
In the dark and someone would scratch your back.
Oh, yes.
Like,
oh, my
Mammy
friends, we all braided each other's hair.
Yes, braid the hair.
Yeah, I loved it when I was the first person in that, either the back scratching chain or the hair playing with chain. Because if you're the first person, you don't have to do anybody else's. The worst is if you're the last person.
This, by the way, is an episode. Movies we saw in school at the end of the year.
You're right.
Or right before winter break. Like, that's an episode. It's coming, people.
Heidi was definitely one of those.
Heidi was big. A Little Princess was another. And she's like, Papa, Papa.
I know.
We loved her. She was the biggest box office draw between 1934 and 1938. But here we are in the 70s and the 80s wanting to be Shirley Temple or squeeze little Shirley Temple. And you have to wonder, like, what was it that brought her into our consciousness? Maybe it was a Saturday afternoon black and white movie. Maybe it was Heidi. Maybe it was a Little Princess. For those of us who are old enough to stay up for Saturday Night Live, it might have been Lorraine Newman, who did a spot-on impression of Shirley Temple. There was also an advertisement on TV for a Shirley Temple doll. Do you remember this?
Yep.
Yes.
Yes. It was like a stand-up doll. It wasn't one that you cuddled. Right. It was one that stood up on a stand. It was like a collector's item. I definitely had that. I think there was a lot of Shirley Temple stuff that got advertised, actually.
For sure. And for me, my gateway for Shirley Temple was my mom, because my mom, who was born in 1943, loved Shirley Temple as a child.
Yep.
Loved. Like, she wanted to be Shirley Temple, too. And she just wanted to be Shirley. And so my mom was telling us all about Shirley Temple.
I knew a lot about Shirley Temple because of my very dangerous bike rides to the public library to check out biographies of
that's right.
Children.
Yes.
Everybody knows about now. Everybody knows if you've been listening for a while. And also because my grandpa, who worked for Warner Brothers, had worked with her. So he would tell me Shirley Temple's stories, and he loved her. He thought she was a little genius. And he said you could show her, like, for her choreography, all you had to do was show it to her one time, and she would have it. She didn't need to, like, go into the studio. She didn't need to. She just had it. She was like a choreographic genius. Is there a dance version of perfect pitch? Because that's what Shirley Temple had.
Yeah.
So, I knew that Shirley Temple, because I knew about Shirley Temple, I knew that she had grown up to be an ambassador. And that was so intriguing.
Oh,
right. Like, what? She's not a
that's
movie
how I learned what an ambassador was.
So many people.
For sure.
Yes. You're like, what the?
But what was
ambassador?
And then you learn her name. What was
Shirley Temple Black.
Black. That's right.
You're like, she has a different name?
Yes. What?
Shirley Temple Black? But the story is so much better than that. Yes, she was an ambassador. But this is how this all happened. And there was more, you guys. There was more. And I can't believe we didn't know this. So when she grew up and she left show business behind, she got involved in the Junior League. And that led to her involvement in Republican politics. Of course, the Republican Party then was a lot different than now, right? And in 1967, she took a gigantic leap and she ran for a congressional seat in her district. She did not win, But that led to her being tapped to represent the United States at a session of the United Nations General Assembly. That's kind of a big deal.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's kind of big. And then Henry Kissinger is at a party, and he's eavesdropping on Shirley Temple, who is now Shirley Temple Black, and he's eavesdropping her talking to a party guest about Southwest Africa. And he's like, do you want to be an ambassador? That's wow. How this happened. He was so surprised that she knew so much about it. Nobody knew anything about it. And so he very quickly realized that she had a special gift. And so under President Gerald Ford, she became the ambassador to Ghana, a job she did so well that then she became the State Department's chief of protocol. She was the first and only, I think even to this day, the only female to ever hold that position. And what that is, it sounds really weird, but what it is that she was the person, she reported directly to the Secretary of State, to Henry Kissinger, and she would prep the president and all of the dignitaries on the various protocol when meeting with foreign dignitaries. That was her job.
Wow.
So then she was famously snubbed by Ronald Reagan. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Hollywood, right?
Mm, he wanted to be the only famous actor, so. Probably in that administration.
She was too cute. She was going to get all of the airtime. But then George H.W. Bush was like, hey, now, let's bring her back. And mm-hmm. he appointed her to be the ambassador to Czechoslovakia. And she was there when the Soviet tanks rolled into town to do whatever history lesson. Google it.
That's a good way to say it.
Yeah. So she escaped. She had to escape to the roof of a hotel while the tanks were rolling into town. And she stood on that roof and she watched in horror as people, like citizens in the street, were being gunned down.
Oh, this is terrible.
Oh, this is Shirley Temple. Yes. Little animal crackers in my soup is watching people.
Little good ship lollipop.
Yes. Right. Mm-hmm. But this is the biggest, you guys. This, I can't believe we didn't know this. She was almost named Gerald Ford's running mate. She was going to be the vice presidential candidate for the 1976 campaign. No joke. So when you should see their faces right now. They're like not making any noise, but their mouths are open. Their mouths are open. So he's going to make the announcement, and she's called to this hotel where the announcement is being made, and she and her husband are put up in a hotel room, and then a White House telephone is installed in her room, and she knows. Like, she knows how this goes. She's been in politics for a long time now, and there's been talk of her being named the running mate, and so she's like, this is it. This is it, you guys. I'm going to be the first female vice presidential candidate in history. About an hour later, the same people who installed the White House phone come in, and they uninstall the phone, and that's when she knew that Bob Dole had been named his running mate.
I am amazed on so many different levels. One, that it was the Republican Party that would have had the first woman running mate person.
Yeah.
And that it was Shirley Temple Black. I mean, there's, wow. Just wow is all I gotta say.
I know.
Because talk about, I mean, that's not even, I don't even know what that is, full circle or not.
I'm dumbfounded. She blew up that circle.
Yes, she did.
No more tap dancing for Shirley Temple. Like, she was world affairs.
Well, thank you, Shirley Temple Black, because I remember that when we were getting ready to do this episode, and Kristen said, I know who I'm doing. I'm going to talk about Shirley Temple. And I thought, yes, we all remember when our parents told us, well, she's an ambassador. And also thinking, I hadn't seen her between, Heidi and when she's on the TV. And I remember thinking, that's what she looks like now. Like,
there was a grown-up lady.
Yes, she was.
Yeah.
And smart.
Yeah. And it was, at the time, it was this sort of like mind meld of this little curly-haired girl doing these funny tap dances and this very grown-up lady doing very adult things.
On the good ship, lollipop, it's a sweet trip to a candy shop where bonbons play. On the sunny beach.
Okay, if I had to ask you guys, who is probably one of the most quintessential 1980s cinematic heartthrobs?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Who would you say character name would be?
Jake Ryan.
Jake Ryan.
Oh,
I mean,
Jake Ryan.
This person, like, he's not somebody that's in our homes for hours and hours and so fleeting.
Yeah, so fleeting. But I mean, the image of him leaning against the car and
the red
just
Porsche.
And just the kiss over the birthday cake. Yes. I mean, all of it. Yeah, and that's Jake Ryan, of course, played by Michael Schoffling. And he basically...
In 16 Candles,
of course, yeah. And if we need to say that to you, this might not be the podcast for you. As much as we hate to say carry on, we might need to say just carry on. So Schoffling basically came to his just like heartthrob status, his prominence... for that role. He was 23 years old. He appeared in 8 additional films after 16 Candles. I knew of a couple of them, and I probably know of more. I just knew one. But when I think of Michael Schoffling, I just think of 16 Candles.
Sure.
But I mean, some of those would have been Vision Quest, Mermaids, Let's Get Harry, Wild Hearts Can't Be Broken. But, you know, he basically found Hollywood pretty lacking personally for personal fulfillment. He wanted a more stable environment to raise his family. So he left the acting world entirely in 1991. That's not that much longer, right?
That's a pretty short career.
Mm-hmm. He moved to a really quiet town in Pennsylvania. I will not disclose it
because Carolyn's
face. Will not disclose it because we are going to respect his privacy.
Okay. We'll tell you after, Carolyn.
But yeah, but he moved there to pursue his true passion, handcrafted woodworking. And you guys, he basically runs a really successful custom furniture shop. And the furniture he creates is gorgeous. It's beautiful. Carolyn, you should go visit him and you should get like a lovely like rocker for your future grandchildren to rock your future grandchildren in. And then you can tell them the story.
Yes.
Guess who made this granny's rocker? Let me tell you the story of Jake Ryan.
It wasn't just that he was so beautiful. It was that his character was so coveted.
And just the standing there, and listen, we all know this, we all feel the same way, but just there's nothing like the hands in the pockets and the feet crossed and the sweater vest.
And his little boat shoes. Didn't he have little boat shoes on?
You guys know how all of my crushes were dark. I mean, you guys know he fits the bill for me. Like, all my crushes sort of looked like Michael Schoffling.
Checking all those boxes.
Well, I got to tell you, you know what? Michael is not the only woodworker amongst our teen idols that grow up and have other passions. Christopher Atkins is a happy little player of wood.
Blue Lagoon is a woodworker?
He's a player of wood. We know. That is not news, Carolyn. Brooke Shields is the player of wood.
Oh, my goodness. He carves these beautiful bowls from... of all things, driftwood.
Oh, I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's softer, probably.
Well, yeah. Yes, mm-hmm. But I'm loving the fact that when I think of Christopher Atkins, I immediately think of the beach, right? I've got paradise in my head. I've got
Blue Lagoon.
Yes, and Blue Lagoon.
He's dragging all the wood in his little loincloth. Is that how he's still collecting?
But he can only drag it with one hand because his other hand has his big fishing spear.
Yeah, right.
So he's dragging and his little loincloth. Well, no, it's probably kind of big loincloth.
But he posts images of these, especially these bowls that he creates that are gorgeous. He sells them. So I will put a link in our show notes with how you can order
Christopher's wood
creation. But anyway, I just thought that was really cool. And it's really cool art. He's very talented. Let's just say that.
I'm so excited. Okay, can we talk about my newest crush?
Yes.
I'm kind of a late bloomer on this one. I'm late to the party on this one. Jonathan Knight from New Kids on the Block. I always call him the reluctant new kid, but I was too old for New Kids on the Block. I was in my 20s, but I recently had the opportunity to re-engage with the reluctant new kid. So Jonathan Knight was the one, he left the band first. He kind of broke the band up in 1990. Not sure. Again, Google it. He was never as comfortable being a heartthrob as the other new kids were. But the band has since come back together and they have an incredible career touring for like screaming screaming middle-aged women. They are beloved, and John seems really happy. But the reason he might be happier now is because his true passion has really been unleashed, and he can do this true passion alongside touring with the New Kids. So this all speaks to, you know, you got to pay the bills and then make room for what makes you happy. So when he first left the band in 1994, he moved to Essex, Massachusetts, which is a small coastal village in Massachusetts with lots of beautiful farmhouses, hundreds of years old. He went into real estate. He bought a farm. He married his longtime partner, Harley Rodriguez, and he took his construction skills and he focused on saving and restoring all of these beautiful farmhouses, which led to one of my favorite shows. TV shows of the last 5 years, HGTV's Farmhouse Fixer, aka Farmhouse Fixer, because he's very much a hometown boy and he still has this thick Boston accent. So Mike and I call it Farmhouse Fixer.
Farmhouse.
So he partnered up with interior designer Christina Creston to restore these farmhouses in these little Massachusetts towns. None of them are very far from his own farm, so he can go home at night and spend time on his farm with all of his animals. He's a total animal daddy. He and every client on the show, they get a special gift from John. Sometimes it might be a donkey or maybe a bunny hutch or a field full of goats to mow the lawn. He's such an animal guy. And Farmhouse Fixa was so popular that it led to a spinoff called Camp Revamp when he and Harley bought a dilapidated camp, that's New England talk for cabin, and he restored it into a lakeside resort with it's not open people because it's not done, but the show is done. They restored it into like a lakeside resort with lots of little cabins that will eventually be for rent. And this show, I mean, if you didn't already love John, you're going to love him even more, because this show, Camp Revamp, includes a lot more of his family, including his little mom Marlene, I think it's Marlene, his little mom. His sisters are in the show, and even his new kid brother, Jordan. Jordan Knight is on Camp Revamp helping him decorate these cabins. It's really funny. It's so homey. It's so full of heart. He's a huge crier. He cries in every show, and it's so full of all the people that he loves. It's really hard not to love it. And now John is all over HGTV, and he really wants to bring back gardening shows. You've noticed gardening shows have kind of left HGTV, home and garden TV. Yeah, where's the garden part? So he wants to bring that back because he's a farmer. He's a farmer.
I was about to say, no, he's not. He's a farmer.
And listen to this quote. Listen to this. It's like the least Hollywood thing that you've ever heard in your whole life. This is from Jonathan Knight. He said, "It's hard when you're on tour because we leave in April and I don't get back until late July. So I miss the whole growing season."
Oh, that stinks for him.
I know. But he's able to live his life in the way that he wants. He's got a very, very full life, and he's being elevated now for who he really is. You can't see me off camera, but I'm raising my hand way up here. Like,
also, he's fulfilled because he's living his life honestly and truthfully.
Totally.
When he was back in the 90s with New Kids, he couldn't probably, he wasn't out, was he?
No, he was not.
Yeah,
in fact,
no
he
way.
Was outed by, he was not, he did not out himself. He was outed by an old boyfriend, which is very unfair. Yeah.
Ugh. That's tragic.
Yeah.
But I was just going to say, now he's living so authentically,
so
not just by what he's following his passions, but just who he is. So he can go shake his booty on stage.
Yes.
So with just so much more freedom, mm-hmm. right?
And guess what?
And
those women still love him, even though he's married to a man and he doesn't play for their team.
Well, and if they don't, carry on.
Yes, carry on.
Carry on.
And you see a lot of Harley in Camp Revamp. So you get to see their relationship, and it's very heartwarming.
Okay, well, I asked you just a bit ago if you had to name who the quintessential 1980s cinematic heartthrob was, like male. Who comes to mind when we think of an absolute definitive it girl of the 1980s?
Okay, this is a very good comparison. Are you talking about Phoebe Cates?
I am talking about Phoebe Cates.
Cates.
I mean,
is
God,
the Jake
and her
Ryan.
Red Bay. And
she's the female Jake Ryan.
She is such a Jake Ryan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just as much as I'm like, oh, remember his sweater vest and his jeans?
Yeah.
Everyone who loved her is saying, remember the red swimsuit or the lack of the red swimsuit? Remember the
Even
red swimsuit top or not the red swimsuit.
Even the little waitress uniform is memorable.
So cute. Yeah. Well, and, you know, for all of us, I mean, it's everything from the covers of Seventeen magazine to Fast Times. And then Gremlins, obviously. She was also a big deal in Gremlins. But we all know she's been married to Kevin Klein. We know that that is a Hollywood couple that we all knew of in 1989, and it was a big deal. But what I did not know is that in 1983, she auditioned for a role in The Big Chill, and it's the role that ultimately went to Meg Tilly.
Oh, I just got goosebumps.
Yeah.
Is that where they met?
So that's when she met him. Yep, that's when she met him.
Wow.
They were both dating other people at the time, but 2 years later, so 2 years after that audition in 1985, they became romantically involved. Yeah, so she changed her name to Phoebe Cates Klein. They moved to the Upper East Side in New York. They have two kids, but guess what? She has really stepped away from, you know, acting since marrying. She really just wanted to focus on her family. And in 2005, she opened a little boutique. It's on Madison Avenue to this day. It's called Blue Tree. It's very upscale. I mean, it's on Madison Avenue.
Yeah, right.
On the Upper East Side. But it's it sells clothing, jewelry, antiques, home goods, decor. I checked out their website, and it's just, it's very eclectic stuff. Ooh. If you Google it, it says owned by Phoebe Cates Klein.
And she opened it in 2005, and it's still
open? In 2005,
yeah.
That says
that's
a lot.
That's significant. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is, that's huge.
It's cute, and you can see the little picture of it. So, yeah, so
that's not somebody with a lark. Like, oh, I'm just trying to open a shop. No, this is somebody who's really dedicated herself to it.
And I think, Michelle, you could probably attest to the fact, because you saw this firsthand, there is somebody that pivoted, and this would be Andrew McCarthy, and he is a writer. And as you might recall from a few episodes ago, Michelle saw Andrew McCarthy at a book signing with his most recent book that was out. And I loved how you said he could have stood up there and talked forever. Like,
oh, he was on. Yeah.
So you saw, really, I think in real time, somebody that is so excited about this creativity that they have. This, for us, we might think of it as a second act because, of course, we loved him back in the 80s in his film, you know, his film characters. But he is a writer. He's won, as we said before, travel award or travel writing awards. Mm-hmm. He's a memoirist and he loves it. It sounds like when you saw him, Michelle, he was exuding joy.
Oh, yeah. And he wrote for, he was worked for like National Geographic for years and years. And travel writing is his true passion. Mm-hmm. And traveling. And traveling.
I just think that was so cool that you got to see him in real time being excited
about
that.
Yeah, so did
that. I.
Being his true self.
I know you did. I know you did.
Being his true self.
And you guys, you know how we talk about the fact that we might be witches?
Yes.
Well,
there's no might about it.
Yeah, we're pop culture witches.
Oh, my gosh, you guys. So, listeners, that just this morning while I was preparing for this episode, I came across a post on Instagram, Matt Dillon's face, all cutie patootie. He's a cutie patootie.
Yeah, he looks good.
Grown up.
Yeah.
And if you guys remember, we're talking Matt Dillon from Little Outsiders. Darlings, from the Outsiders, all those things.
Rumblefish.
Yes, yes, gosh. He was Gen X films to the hilt. Anyway, you guys, he is also a painter. And he is having his first gallery show open in the next few weeks, maybe. I didn't read the whole article about it, but he has been painting for the last several decades, but had no like official representation. It was kind of just what he did during the lulls of when he was maybe filming something or just in between projects. And he's very articulate about art. Mm-hmm. There's a video where they ask him who are his artistic influences, and it's over my head. But suffice it to say, he is so happy and creative and leaning into this. And he's having a gallery show. I mean, they just don't do that for any Tom, Dick, or Harry.
No,
like, you have to be good. It doesn't matter, you know, what your past was. It's kind of like, okay, you have to be pretty talented to make this happen and for you to be in a gallery.
And I loved his pieces. I thought they were really interesting. I really, really liked it. You know, abstract art like that is always, you never know how you're going to respond to it. And I really liked it.
Well, think about who we just recently talked to, Eve Plum.
Yes.
You know, she's had many gallery shows. She sells her art and she also has gotten into design. Her true passion is art.
Mm-hmm. And you could even see that when we talked to her, she just kind of lit up. I just felt her almost lighter and stuff in our conversation about her art. And she was really really touched that we knew about it and wanted to talk about it with her. So, yeah, I think that these, again, these celebrities who were maybe pigeonholed into a certain way for us to think about them really appreciate when we, especially the three of us as interviewers, ask them about these other parts of their lives, especially their creative lives. And listeners, you're going to get to hear that firsthand in just a few minutes because we had the opportunity to chat with our friend, Greg Evigan, okay? And he is so much more than BJ and the Bear and my two dads. Am I right, ladies?
It's incredible. Think of how long ago BJ and the Bear was. You guys, that was almost 50 years ago. And we're talking to him today, not about what happened 50 years ago, but what is next on the horizon for him and this amazing thing that he's created now, right now.
Right. He's able to celebrate this at age 72.
It's amazing. Right. It's amazing. Yes.
And it's a passion, too, that he's had from when he was a child. So he never really gave up on this dream. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the age that he is now and everything, it just gave him the opportunity to say, I want to do this thing that I've been thinking about for a really long time. And that thing, ladies and gentlemen, would be an album that he has coming out. And you'll hear all about it in our conversation. And it's not just any old music, okay? I mean, we're talking the London Royal Philharmonic.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So we hope you enjoy this conversation that we had with the multi-talented Greg Evigan.
Hi, everybody. Let's pause here because I want to tell you about two books that we've been reading. As you know, the three of us are always on the lookout for books with nostalgic vibes, and we had two land on our desk this week from best-selling author of many other sexy, messy, sort of erotic suspense novels, Kate Stewart. It's a duology, and they have to be read together. The first one is called Drive. That's out now, and the sequel, Reverse, is coming soon. So here's the funny part. The nostalgia we're talking about is the early 2000s. That's nostalgia now, people. And I'm really trying to wrap my head around it. So Drive follows a music journalist who's torn between two men. It's an angsty, steamy, rock star romance with a killer 2000s playlist. Okay, you had me at playlist, right? And the story will continue with Reverse. And in this one, the next generation uncovers secrets from the past and finds their own love story and their own playlist. The songs are important, and each chapter opens with a song that you'll remember and love. These books are for people who like Colleen Hoover, and they are spicy, you guys. They are sizzling, high, high spice. So if you're into sexy, spicy, dark rock star romances with a playlist, check them out. Drive is out now, and Reverse is coming soon.
Here's somebody we knew from one of our favorite TV shows growing up. We saw him in Dynamite Magazine. We saw him on every after-school talk show. But little did we know that he was a musician first. And despite the literally hundreds of TV and film credits to his name between the 1970s and now, today he's here to celebrate what feels to me like a crowning achievement. Greg Evigan, star of BJ and the Bear and My Two Dads and hundreds of other films and TV appearances, has released a new album of his original compositions recorded with London's legendary Royal Philharmonic Orchestra called simply Greg Evigan and the London Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. And he is here to tell us about it today. Greg Evigan, thank you so much for being here today and welcome to the Pop Culture Preservation Society.
Thank you. Yeah. Thanks for that great introduction. That's great.
You are welcome. Yeah. That's you, man. I didn't do that. You did that.
All right. Okay. All right.
That's your resume.
Right.
This is not the first time that we've spoken with you. We have a great episode from 2023 where you sort of hinted about this project that was coming. And here we are 3.5 years later, and you've really done it. So
finally.
Congratulations.
Yay,
to
congratulations.
You. That's such good news.
Thank you.
We want to make sure that everybody listening will have access to it so they can hear it in full. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But I just wanted to tell you how I felt about it when I was listening to it. It was quite a reprieve to everything that is thrown to me by my various platforms. Mm-hmm. It was a lovely moment for me to just be in the moment and be still and appreciate the sounds that were flowing into my ears. It felt like something, I felt like I should be in the tub. I really felt like I could be in the tub. And just...
That's a first, man. That's good. I love that. In the tub tapes. Yeah.
Yes, in the tub tapes. I really, really appreciate it. It was beautiful. This is beautiful music.
Thank you.
Yes. It's truly soaring. Listeners, these tracks fill the room. That's how I felt about it when I was listening to it. And I have to say that the last track, it's called Conquering the Rainbow, didn't just fill the room for me. I don't know what happened to me, Greg, but I got really emotional listening
to it. Were you in the tub?
No, I wasn't in the tub. No, I'm going to listen to it in the tub later. Right. No, but when I
say... Be careful.
All the songs like filled my room, but something about Conquering the Rainbow filled me and then spilled over. Like,
wow.
I got really emotional. So that is credit to you for composing that to elicit that type of a reaction. But it's the whole thing is just very lush and large and beautiful.
Kind
of sticking with the bathtub theme. I mean, it kind of did like Calgon, take me away. I mean, that's kind of what it did for me listening. And kind of to the point that Kristen made, we recently recorded a podcast episode just about embracing more analog activities and just trying to get away from this sense of urgency and rush, rush, rush that life seems to be coming at us. And so your music found me at the perfect time because it is exactly what I needed to just exhale and sit and then have that experience that Michelle described and Kristen described. It literally kind of swept me away to somewhere else that I needed to be and not in this present, just on all the time kind of moment. And so I thank you. It found me and maybe a lot of your fans from back in the day. It's finding us at a time in our lives where we just want to exhale and be swept away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. You guys, that's beautiful. It's analog for sure. The whole thing was, in fact, it was recorded on 2-inch tape. Anybody who remembers that stuff.
Wow.
Yeah. So, this was a long drawn out process to get this done. I lost the entire thing in between. And then just imagine having it all done. And I take it I said to my son, Jace, I said, Jace, don't you think there's something missing on the bottom? The bottom end is not there for me. And there was no bass. So literally, I had to go back, get the right machines, transfer the whole thing again.
Oh my God.
Back off the tape and then onto Pro Tools and then continue on. And I was pretty discouraged. Needless to say, I was pretty discouraged in the middle of that, all that, and let years go by before I said, you know what? You got to finish this, man. It's haunting you.
Oh,
you got
really?
To finish
oh my God.
This.
Years went by.
Yeah, yeah. This was a long, long project.
Is like a labor of love.
Yeah, it's definitely a labor of love.
I mean, labor. Yeah. And so what would you estimate from the time you started thinking, I'm going to, do these compositions and I'd love to get it recorded, and then all of that happened to now?
Let's say 20 years.
How long are we talking?
Let's go 20.
20 years.
You are. I mean, I want to be honest with you about it because I think the entire process has been something that I can encourage anybody out there that's listening to say, listen, keep going. No matter what you do, you can get something out there.
Yeah.
If you really, and this is unusual because of what happened. But, now I learned so much in the process that I would absolutely be able to do it in, 10 years. No, just kidding.
Yeah. That's a testament. Maybe like, two. Here you are and you did it. Yeah. And so I think that's a really important message to people. There is no deadline for your art. There
exactly,
is no deadline
right.
for uh-huh. your creativity.
And I think what you described and what you felt, not to interrupt you, but I want to go with what you said, was the way you felt has a lot to do with kind of when you talk analog. I'm really talking analog. I mean, analog to digital, but there is something in the translation that's a warmth that you feel. And I think you feel some of that warmth when you hear it, because it does translate. Ultimately you go to digital.
Yeah.
But that warmth translates from the tape.
That's very real. Yeah. And that does elicit, what you were talking about, Michelle. There are some songs that make you have an emotional response and some you just don't. And I think that that has something to do with it. It really does.
Yeah. It was one of those situations where it just caught me too. Like I didn't know what was happening. All of a sudden I was listening and then it was just like in your throat and then out your eyes. And
oh man, that's beautiful. Thank you.
If you'd like to take us along with you on your press tour,
I think you guys
are available.
You're available.
Well, and I know you said 20 years, but I think a lot of your career could kind of be a testament to synchronicity and serendipity, and that things, even though 20 years seemed like a long time, we weren't around, you know, 20 years ago to help you promote it. I wasn't in a place where maybe
there were no podcasts.
That's another thing too that I wanted to mention is that, like, you're bringing it up actually, but I really don't think I would have had as good an album if I would have done it then and now. I really don't think so. The technology, you know, that I was able to use now, just for cross cuts, cross fades, you know, whatever it is, you know, just to make it, you know, really sound kind of seamless in a way, you know, I feel, but still have the, but not take away just the warmth of it, the way, the edges, you know, you don't want to lose all the, there's a few rough edges. It's great. You know, that's what humans do. So, that's how humans play. So if you take all that away, then you have, maybe just a plain AI produced type of
that's AI.
Sound.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's no, and then you get no emotional reaction to it.
Yeah.
Because we're not human to human. I want to let our listeners know, how do you classify this music? Because when I'm listening to it, I'm thinking it's called classical, but then I know that refers to a specific time period, and I'm a dumbass. So I don't know, like, are you just calling it like instrumental music? What, how do you classify it?
I just call it, when somebody says, I say, well, it's kind of movie theme-ish. You know,
I just get that vibe.
Like a score. Okay, if we were to play a little piece for a little clip for our listeners, do you have what piece on that album would you like them to hear most? And tell us about it.
Well, you know, the one you mentioned, I mean, I like, I have a little feeling for all of them.
Oh, sure.
But, you know, over time, you know, you definitely, you feel your favorites, you know, what you think moves you the most, me the most. Conquering the Rainbow, to me, has a special place because that's why I saved it for last. I wanted to have that powerful ending.
But it
also takes you through so many changes from the way it starts. Like, it doesn't go to where you think it's going to go, you know. And then
how it ends.
And then, exactly.
That's and then the, how it ends, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit of I loved the titles of the pieces. We don't have to go through every one, but if there are titles that stick out to you that you want to share why you use that title, Kenbo, what does that mean to you?
One of them, I think you mentioned it, that was the Tears Like Rain. That was the one I wrote when I was 16. So that's one that I had done, but it wasn't as developed then. You know what I mean? I actually, you know, it matured as time went by. And especially after you, you know, it's with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra, then, you know, you have to come up to a different level. So, but when it comes to the names, I just, after time goes by, I just had kind of a, like, I remember with Tears Like Rain, it wasn't called that when I was 16. It didn't have any title, you know, but sometimes I get overwhelmed myself when I hear things, you know, like when you're in the studio and you hear your, you know, you hear your pieces, your songs come to a point where like a 65, you go from playing the piano to a 65 piece orchestra and it's overwhelming. Right. So, for writers, I know writers and anybody who hears their stuff come to life like that. You know, it's an incredible feeling. So I remember I think I cried Tears Like Rain and so, you know, that's where
beautiful.
That came from.
And
then Synchrony,
and you felt like you conquered the rainbow.
I felt like you conquered the rainbow. That's like it was like Don Quixote, you know, it was like some guy who's out there conquering the world and nobody knew what's at the end. Nobody knows what's at the end of that rainbow, because obviously we know that there's probably nothing but vapors of. But you know what I mean? It's like conquering something that doesn't exist, you know? And so in a lot of ways in the world, we're conquering things that don't exist. We're going after things that don't exist.
It's so interesting to hear that some of these pieces have been in the works since you were a teenager, because you were before you were an actor, right? You were a musician.
Yeah. Always,
I believe we talked about your band and it had an interesting name, right?
I think I asked you about your plums last time.
Yep.
The plums? The royal plums?
There we go. Yeah. The royal plums.
That was
there it is.
That was one of the first bands we had, Royal Plums. Oh, my God. Where
and
did
how
we come
old
up
were
with
you?
I think when I was in that band, I think I was, I must have been maybe 12. 13?
My God. Yeah. This is really the definition of musician first, right? So this is what we're learning is that you are a musician first. And so, and you, when you were only 12 years old, how did you end up as an actor? How did that happen? How is it that, you know, you have this within you and it's the focal point of your life. And we're here talking about BJ and the Bear. Like, how does that happen?
Well, the steps were, I started playing the piano when I was 8. My mom was a great pianist, and she was incredible. So it was something to watch. You could see, oh, wow, boy, I would love to play like that someday, you know. And she got me into the lessons. So I started studying, but it was classical. So everything was, you know, reading music and learning how to, you know, it's kind of like, you know, Chopin, Beethoven, you know, Gershwin, all those things, right? All those composers. So, two-part inventions, Bach. Then when I went into, you know, got into the bands, it's like chords, you know. And then in school, I had this, I had a drama teacher who was, his name was Pat Arvonio. He's a great guy and very eclectic guy. He went from, he was the warden at Rahway State Prison, New Jersey.
Ooh,
and then, he comes, he's teaching drama in high school.
Wow.
He was an incredible, incredible teacher. He had a lot of life to give, you know. I was learning, I was getting some of the tools I needed to, but little did I ever know that, you know, my friend Gary Delina, he's a comedian in New Jersey. We've been a friend for life. Gary says, he sees this article in Variety and audition for Jesus Christ Superstar. And we just graduated high school. So I went in, you know, I went in and, I mean, it was 15,000 people wrapped around from 51st all the way to 52nd.
Auditioning, like 15,000 people auditioning?
Huge, huge. Oh, we thought there wasn't going to be anybody there because the article was so small. It was an open call, you know? So we went and pretty much we just got in line. It's like, we thought we walk right up to the front door like, hey, we're here, you know? And I knew every song on that album. I mean, I learned every song. And we got down to the door and the guy at the door says, Charlie, he says, pick 12 bars, you know, he's yelling out, pick 12 bars. I'm thinking, I'm not picking 12 bars. I'm going in. I'm just going in. And I sang Garden of Gethsemane and they never stopped me. And I ended up getting the show. Right. So I got the show.
Right. And what role did you play?
I was on the, road tour first. So I was on the original road tour. So we got split into three groups.
Wait, the original road tour? Like the first group that went out to do Jesus Christ Superstar?
Yep, first one.
Wow.
So we got, we were all cast the same day. The New York production was cast. So he said, they put us in three groups, A, B, and C. I was in B. They said, group C, thank you very much for your summer, because we all went through a whole summer of auditions.
Oh, wow.
And then group B, you are the first official Broadway road tour. And group A, you are the first official Broadway company. So, hey, I was happy to be in any place, you know.
Yes. Well, and you're 18 years old, right?
Just graduated high school.
I was 17, actually. I was 17.
You were 17.
Yeah, I was born in October, so I was, how do you get stuck in that?
Oh, yeah, I'm one of those.
Yeah, okay, all right. So, you know what it's like, trying to keep up with everybody. And so that was, you know. That was how I literally got a job as a singer at 17 in Jesus Christ Superstar. And I wasn't thinking anything of acting. I was just thinking of the singing. And then came, you know, the mixture of the two when I got into Greece after that, right after that. So
that's right.
Oh my God.
But,
Jesus Christ, I love how Superstar Jesus Greece. Christ Superstar was like your gateway drug.
Just to ask. I know, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Believe me, I look back at that wow. You know,
then things just started happening. But what I think is cool is that then even, you know, you've been able to combine your love of acting and then composing, because you wrote the theme to My Two Dads, didn't you?
I co-wrote it with Lenny McAleese.
You can count
on me.
Yeah, we wrote that. We wrote that in 20 minutes.
Come on.
20 minutes.
You can count on me.
No matter what you do, you can count on me. No matter where you go, you can count on me.
Can you tell I loved that show?
Like,
that was right in my wheelhouse. I loved that show. Who's the actress? Oh, my God. Remind me, the judge.
Florence Stanley.
Oh, Lord. Yeah, she's hilarious.
She's great.
I loved that woman. I loved that show. That was like a not miss show for me.
All right.
But also, you sang the theme to BJ and the Bear?
Yeah, I did.
Yep. Correct?
Yep.
Rolling down to Dallas, my wings provide my palace. Off to New Orleans, or who knows where? Places new and ladies too. I'm BJ McKay, and this is my best friend.
So that's really cool. So are those the only two shows that you were able to kind of mesh your two loves,
passions? There was one more.
What's the other one?
P.S. I Love You with Connie Sullick.
I forgot about that show until you just mentioned it.
Yeah, it was.
God, I loved Connie Sullick. And she was a big Battle of the Network Stars contestant, yeah. As were you.
She's still a great friend. We hang out with those guys all the time. They're good friends of ours, yeah.
Gosh.
We're going to her daughter's wedding next month. You're getting...
Nuh-uh.
Yeah.
Listeners, you're getting behind-the-scenes scoop.
Wait, is she married to someone famous?
Just
I feel like she was married to someone
famous. Was she ever married to Gil Gerard or no?
Yes, she was.
Oh, good memory, Carolyn. Yeah.
Good memory, Carolyn. Yeah. Very good.
Yeah, he just passed away, too.
Oh, that's right.
Oh, no.
That's right.
Oh, that's really sad. Well, I love knowing that you all are still friends. We love that kind of information. That's so fun.
Yeah, real people.
Friends. We love those guys. Yeah.
I was also thinking how great like TV programming was in the 70s and 80s because we could learn that you were a singer because you would be on Mike Douglas or Merv Griffin.
John Davidson,
daytime kind of talk shows and then variety shows, which another thing we're missing in life, and just the chance for you to break out. Like there were opportunities for actors to maybe show their, musical chops. I mean, when you sing with What Do You Do in New Year's Eve with Marie Osmond, I think you tickle the ivories a little bit in that Christmas episode of, the Osmonds Christmas special. But that was just a great time in TV programming and different formats because we could learn that you actually sang the BJ and the Bear theme song. We might not have known that had we not seen you perform it.
Yeah, you bring up that point, that's what to me is missing with everything today is because people are so disjointed in their own groups now. Everybody's kind of split because in those days it was kind of like the zeitgeist of television. It was like everybody was in the same, we were all in the same room. We had four channels, mostly four, maybe five. And so whatever you saw on those, that was everybody's reality. That was the reality, And then you had, like you said, all those other shows, which kind of promoted the show that you were doing on the network. But now it's so dispersed. I remember when we came on the air with BJ, we had a 47 share. If anybody out there who thinks about shares anymore that knows what that means compared to today, like if you get close to a one share now, just close to a one share, you're a hit.
Yeah. How could you even measure it today? Like how could... Everything is so siloed that there's no one thing that every single person is watching. Last night, I was watching a show with my whole family, and within 5 minutes, my 23-year-old was like, I am not watching this with you, my parents, because there was just something he did not want to see with his parents. And there's so little that we can actually watch together.
For
instance, some of those variety specials I was talking about, you were on... Debbie Boone's had a variety special that you were on, and you were on with Gene Kelly and Bob Hope. So my whole family, parents had some people that they enjoyed and admired, and I had somebody that I liked. So we could all sit down, we all love Debbie Boone, and then I got my Greg Evigan, they got their Gene Kelly. You got, it was just a time where they almost had to be a little bit more mindful with how they cast some of these specials and shows because you only have probably one TV in the house, maybe two if you're lucky at that point.
Yeah.
So how can we get the whole family together and everybody gets,
feel kind of good to see their person on there. So you're right. It just so much silos us now that, to your point, Kristen, it's, mm-hmm. you know, nothing to keep Liam in the room. So he's out of there. But
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you still sing?
Yeah.
Do you still do you have albums, like vocal albums?
Well, you know, I'm working on that right now. I've written like about 20 songs that I really, really like. So what I'm going to do is, but I wrote them mostly for other people, you know, because, you know, I got that Meghan Trainor. I don't know if you knew about that, but I got
please
got
tell our people
about
Meghan Trainor.
Tell us about that.
Well, that's it's called I Don't Do Maybe. It's on her Timeless album, and it's a great song. So I brought that to Jason, my son, and Gian Stone, who he's working with, and then they got it in her ear, and then that's how it all happened, you know.
So you're the writer on that song, which was a hit for Meghan
Trainor.
Yeah,
I Don't Do Maybe. I brought that to him with my demo that I had, that I did. It's not like the old days where they would say, where they go to the Brill Building in New York and get songs from writers. It's just a different time. So,
yeah.
So, you know, Jason is always keeping my stuff in mind, which is great. My son, you know, and he's doing great in the business. And,
tell everyone,
give me those choruses. Give me those choruses.
Aww, yes.
Tell everyone listening, about your son, like how he's involved in what you do and what he does.
Yeah. Well, the way he started, you know, he started in my studio. You know, he's always very thankful that I always said, you know, go ahead, yeah, use the studio. Then he took it over pretty much. But he started out with, you know, one song he did for Disney, and then he did a Demi Lovato song, Heart Attack. That really got him going. And he wrote a great song. Oh yeah, and he's working with Benson Boone right now, so he's got a lot of songs on Benson Boone's album. He's got, I think he's got five on the last album, and
as a writer or a producer,
as a writer producer, okay. He's a writer producer.
Well, let me ask you, since you said you sometimes work together, and what is that like? Because I imagine working with any of my children, and I don't know that it would be productive. So, what is that like? Do you see each other as equals? How does that work?
The amazing thing is whenever we work together, we immediately click. It's like we immediately write something really good, you know?
Oh, wow.
It's like we have this genetic thing going that we just kind of think the same way. We wrote a song together maybe, I don't know, a few months ago, but we must have finished it in the entire thing with production and everything in 3 hours.
Oh,
and it was a killer. It was a killer song, you know?
People would kill for a writing partner like that.
I know.
Is that something that you could then go and record at Abbey Road like you did with this album? Or is it a very specific reason that you go to Abbey Road to record and produce?
Well, yeah, I think because, you know, I can do everything here.
Okay.
And it comes out great. I mean, I did a lot of the end of the Abbey Road thing here. Then I ended up here kind of getting the final warmth that I wanted. Let's put it
that way. In the mixing of it.
Yeah, the mixing. Okay. I did all the mixing, you know, because I did all the editing, and Joe Curiel did the orchestrations, and he did such a great job on the orchestrations. I mean, that's a lot of what you feel.
And I love how, and you touched on this just a little bit when you were talking about the tears,
tears
like rain when you heard it, because composing all these, you had really just heard this on the piano, correct?
Right.
And then all of a sudden, you have this 65-piece orchestra, which is not just like some flukes we got together. I mean, this is the London, you know, the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. Yeah. And you're in this iconic studio. I mean, that had to have just been overwhelming.
It was. It was overwhelming.
Wonderful. Yeah.
It really was. I hope I can do it again. I have another almost eight ready to go again. So I've been working on the next one already.
Volume 2?
Volume 2.
And you've got that learning curve. You're on the other side of that learning curve.
Yeah, I'm definitely not taking 20 years, man.
So, exactly.
Abbey Road. Abbey Road makes me think of the Beatles, which makes me think of musical influences. And I'm always really fascinated with what people's first influences were when they were children, when they were teenagers. What was the first album that was meaningful to you when you were a kid or when you were a teenager?
When I was a kid, I mean, I remember on the Ed Sullivan Show, this takes you way back, right? So my sister and I remember us, you know, and we don't even know what happened to us. It was like, and because, you know, we got this old black and white half static television, you know, sitting there on the, and my sister and I were jumping up and down like kids do, you know, and my parents were close by, and all of a sudden they hear us screaming, right? They hear us like just jumping up and down. We're going crazy. We don't even know why we're going crazy. My sister's crying.
Oh,
right?
My God.
She's crying. And I'm like, what is she crying about? I don't get that. And, but whatever you, what was that, 62 or something like
64.
That?
64.
64. Okay, 64. Yeah. And so we were just jumping up and down, going crazy. And ever since that day, I was a Beatle fan. I mean, forget it. That was, they were without a doubt, you know.
I don't know why that makes me want to cry, but it kind of makes me want to cry.
Yeah, because it's more than just the music. The whole experience.
Right, but then we're all like, meh,
because like you're just asking who was your first musical influence, but yet that was on the tail end of him talking about being in Abbey Road.
Yes, I know.
Studios, recording his own music. Like that's
oh, when
that's
we got
crazy.
There that day, it was, I'd tell you this part, because Joe and I said, Joe, we got to take our shoes off and walk across the street. And so we did. We took some pictures. I got to find these pictures. But when we got there, I said, whoa, wait a minute, man. The Volkswagen's here. So they were doing a reenactment.
What?
That day that we happened to be there. So they had the Volkswagen bus there. They had the whole, I said, can you believe this, Joe? So we just took a bunch of pictures. And
again, feeling like I'm going to cry a little bit.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Just this synchronicity. Again, I feel like that's such a thread throughout your career. If like you hadn't been at certain places at certain times, it's just amazing.
Yeah, Carol, you're right about that, because that's the way everything has always gone. It's always been like the thing you least expect. And you kind of have to go with it, right? You just have to.
That's a lesson.
That's why I always tell people, you know, the only thing you got to do, young artists that are starting out, the only thing you got to do is be ready. Just be ready.
Wow.
Because you never know.
That's a great message.
You never know when. Yes. You don't know what's going to happen. Yes. I mean, if you're not ready, then, you know, then you're in trouble.
Just move along.
You know, right. Then somebody else gets it, you know,
We often talk, amongst ourselves about how people listen to music today, because it's so different and there's so many different ways to do it. So how we listen to it today versus how we did it when we were growing up, analog versus digital, owning something tangible versus streaming something. How do you want people to listen to your music?
Well, you know, that's the thing about, we were talking about this, we had a conversation about what you're saying. And I heard this, I think it was a podcast. Somebody said, the difference in now and then is people used to actually invest in you. Like you invested in an artist. I couldn't wait for an album to come out. I was going to go down and I'm buying that album right away.
Right.
So I've actually invested in that artist, which, you know, propagates the love and the feeling and everything that you have for that artist. Right. Now people, if they listen to it very quick and they're like, I like that. Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, next thing, you know, so there's no investment. And so when I say investment, you know, people, you might think right away, oh, you mean you wanted me to buy your album, you know? Yeah, well, it's nice if you buy an artist's album because you're supporting the artist. It cost me to make the album, I'll tell you, about 60,000, right? So now, do you think I'm going to make that on Spotify? I mean, I'd have to have like, you'd have to have, I don't know how many billions just to make maybe $10,000, you know, maybe if you're lucky. But when I say invest, the thing that you really want, I think every artist wants what you said, what you guys said right in the beginning, how you felt. That's what they want. They want you to feel a piece of what they're feeling, you know, and that's the thing that I could say would be the most valuable thing is to have people feel, you know, what you feel when you make it, when you're creating it and you're putting it together.
Right. That's worth, I mean, it can sound a little cliche, but that's priceless, right?
It is priceless.
To have achieved that, It's almost like, yeah, you can't put a dollar sign.
Yeah.
Right.
You're making it's got to make tears connection. Like rain. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly right. Like,
yes.
You know, if you feel that way, you know, that's the thing.
And we're all, you know, feeling those feelings together. Just something special. So we're so grateful that, you know, you get it. Like, I feel like we're team you. We're on the same page. We kind of know how to make people feel. And that's something that I think is really important. And so, Greg, this has been beyond a pleasure. I mean, we're always excited to chat with
people. Me too, by the
way.
For me too. I feel the same way.
Thank you. Yeah, so thank you for sharing the stories and especially these full circle moments. I mean, the chills I still have from you and your sister watching the Beatles to you know, recording this album that you're talking to us about at Abbey Road Studios. I mean, what else do we need to say? It's just like, you know, mic drop. We can't wait to see where this music takes you. And we look forward to talking to you again.
All right, same here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Adam. I really appreciate that. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Anytime. So good to see you. Yeah.
You too.
What an incredible conversation that was with Greg Evigan. He is truly one of the nicest guys. He is smart. We all just feel better.
Yeah,
after we've talked to him, we truly do.
We're all fans.
And we would love for you to order a physical copy of his album. It's available in vinyl and on CD at evigan.com, just Evigan, not gregevigan.com, evigan.com. It's a great website. I mean, right away, you get to see his beautiful face. You get to, you know, find out what he's doing. And there's a tab at the top that says shop. And you also can hear a sample of this album that we've just been talking about, but we're all huge fans of him and huge fans of this album, and we think you'll love it too.
Oh, we know you will. Yeah.
This should be inspiring for all of us. Everything that we've talked about here, talking with Greg Evigan about his new things and all of the people that came before, we are never just one thing, and we need to listen hard to ourselves, to our hearts, to see what messages we're being sent, right? If your job is not satisfying to you, can you make room for the thing that does make you happy? All of these celebrities have shown us that it is never too late. We are still becoming who we are, and it does not need to be something that will make you money. Sometimes those things we love will never pay the bills, and that is okay. Pay the bills with something else and look for pockets of your life that would allow you to become even more. Thanks so much for listening today, and we will see you next time.
And before we go, we want to say a sincere thank you to our Patreon supporters. Your support truly means the world to us. You help keep this show alive. You believe in what we're doing. And you're part of this community in a way that feels a lot like the old days, sharing stories, memories, and moments that shaped us. We're so grateful you're on this ride with us. And today we're giving a special thank you shout out to these Patreon supporters. T. Will. Don't know who that is, but again, sometimes they just give us their email. T. Will, we see you. Dawn, Teresa, Janice, Melissa, Lisa, Melinda, Christina, Michelle, Lee, Maria, Bonnie, Lori, Liz, and Carrie. K-E-R-I, Carrie.
Love it. Thank you guys so
much. Thank you.
And another way that you can help support us and keep this Gen X nostalgia train chugging along is by rating, reviewing, subscribing, and sharing the show with everybody that you know. You can consider it your good deed of the day, kind of just like rewinding that VHS before returning it to Blockbuster. Remember those days?
Be kind. Rewind. In the meantime, let's raise our glasses for a toast, courtesy of the cast of Three's Company, to good times.
To happy days.
To Little House on the Prairie.
Cheers, everybody.
Cheers.
The information, opinions, and comments expressed on the Pop Culture Preservation Society podcast belong solely to Carolyn, the Crushologist, and Hello Newman, and are in no way representative of our employers or affiliates. And though we truly believe we are always right, there is always a first time. The PCPS is written, produced, and recorded in Minneapolis, Minnesota, home of the fictional WJM Studios and our beloved Mary Richards. Nanu Nanu, keep on truckin', and may the force be with you.
Before we dive into today's trip down memory lane, a quick shout out to the fine folks at Remind Magazine, who help keep the nostalgia train rolling. This season, the Pop Culture Preservation Society is proudly sponsored by Remind, the publication that understands your collection of Tiger Beat magazines, TV guide issues, and random lunchboxes is not clutter, it's history. We love when Remind lands in our mailboxes, and we can enjoy that analog experience of flipping through its pages and reading all about the classic TV shows and movies and music and all of those pop culture treasures that made us who we are. And as an exclusive offer to PCPS listeners, you can get a full year of Remind magazine for just $12. That's 86% off the cover price. Just go to remindmagazine.com/pop. That's remindmagazine.com/POP. And you can take advantage of this incredible offer. Trust us, you will be so glad you did.